Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 273 of the Roguecast, recorded October 15, 2019. A Psychic Snickers. Okay, if we sound a little more addled than usual, first of all, you won't notice, because we're pretty addled in general.
I was going to say.
But we're recording this as opposed to like midday on a Tuesday after having just done the comics poll. We're recording this at 9 p.m. as we wait to reopen for the midnight release of X-Men number one.
Right. So our schedule is crazy off. It's a different time of day. We don't know what to do.
No, it's nighttime. We're all tired.
Yeah. And expect bitterness. This will be the most bitter of all podcasts.
All right. With that said, I'm just going to jump right into news.
Yep. Bitter news.
Bitter news. No, good news, at least as I see it. The big news came out from Deadline today that Kevin Feige is... I don't know if I'm sure about it. Is it Kevin Feige? Kevin Feige? Kevin
I've heard so many pronunciations.
I think it's Feige.
I think it's a Cumberbatch
I believe Feige is correct, but... nobody could tell me for certain. I bet even if he himself was here, he would not know.
So, Kevin Feige, who has been sort of running Marvel, he's really the guy who's been in charge of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and the guy largely responsible for it.
Yep. Clearly a person who, in a way that I think no other major overseer of any, you know, like, sort of superhero production has, got it.
Yeah.
And, like... You know, like, they make changes in the Marvel movies, but the fans let it go because they recognize that there are changes that work for the movies, the heart of the movie, the comics are still there, and in fact, just like Batman the Animated Series, in some cases they even better them occasionally.
I agree.
So he's a notable player for many reasons.
Well, he is now becoming the Chief Creative Officer at Marvel, which essentially means that Marvel TV and animation are going to move under, so he's going to be overseeing all of that, which... We don't know what that means for Jeff Loeb, but it probably means that he's not in charge of anything anymore.
Randy?
Yep.
I know you're Jeff Loeb fan number one, so they probably heard your cheering in China.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. This also speaks to maybe Ike Perlmutter having a... He is still chairman, but he is possibly having a little bit of a decreased influence over the whole thing.
That'd be
because
nice.
He and Feige have butted heads. Like, Feige almost left over that.
Do we know what this means for comics?
Now, it says it is expected, nobody knows, is expected Joe Quesada will remain creative lead for Marvel Entertainment because he's their chief creative officer.
Yeah.
Reporting to Dan Buckley, who is the publisher. Dan Buckley reports to, he's the president of Marvel Entertainment. He reports to Ike Perlmutter, who is the chairman. But the important thing about this is Feige is definitely getting, this is a bump up for him.
Yeah.
This is definitely him. In addition to running the movies, expect the TV and the animation to come much more in line with what's been done on the MCU, especially as Disney Plus comes out and they're basically producing everything straight to that pipeline.
There's a part of me that would still be a little bit nervous, just in the sense that we know he's great at movies. Now he's juggling so much that I worry that about anything that upsets the alchemy. Right, just because the alchemy has been so good.
I get that, but here's where I come down on this.
What if he's a true wizard and nothing will faze him?
You know, Gandalf got killed by a Balrog.
He came back.
Yeah, he came back as Gandalf the White.
You ready for the couple movies they're going to make while he's dead?
Here's the thing.
This will be the dark times.
Avengers Endgame.
That's when they're going to get the Venom one.
Avengers Endgame wrapped the Marvel Cinematic Universe in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So what are they doing next? While I'm excited about it, I don't mind if they stumble a little bit because they've completed a 22 movie cycle.
No, I don't want them to stumble because I don't want those headlines of Marvel finally capsizes and they're dead.
Me neither.
I just don't want that.
Yeah, me neither. But
you know what happens when that happens? We say like, come to the comics. We've always been here. We always will be.
Yeah. No, comics are dying. They have been for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, haven't you seen those articles floating around?
I hear a lot of sadness, but then Marvel had its 80th anniversary, and everybody seemed fine.
Yeah. All right. But that's good news to me. I'm excited about this. Less excited, but also interested. Venom 2 news. So, Woody Harrelson's Carnage will be teaming up with Shriek, who is his sonic-powered girlfriend from the comics.
I actually haven't been paying attention to Carnage comics. I didn't know he had a girlfriend, but applaud.
This is a
good
this,
for him.
Good for him.
I'm glad. I hope he's happy.
Sociopath.
She has sonic powers, which is going to make her dangerous to Venom.
Right.
It's true.
Venom gets disrupted.
But isn't it
by
dangerous
science.
To him as well, since he has a spawn
well,
of Venom?
Well, he probably is like, babe, don't shriek at me.
Or there'll be carnage.
That's possible. What's interesting is...
what if that's the only reason he's dating her? Is like he's not really into it, but he's like, she could shriek at me and it would be bad. So he's like, shriek at other people.
I mean, Woody Harrelson could play that, I'm sure.
Yeah, honestly, I'm down for it.
Are you guys excited about Venom 2?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to go see it in theaters. It's fine.
Are you legitimately excited, or are you excited to see it on a sort of camp level?
I mean, a little
it's
bit of
It's somewhere
that.
In between. Yeah. Okay. Somewhere in between. Like, I actually, like, really kind of enjoyed the weirdness of that movie, and,
Tom Hardy's weirdness, sold it.
Yeah, it was finally the right role for him. For him, for me. Because
I don't like many of his other ones.
I don't particularly, like, I don't know what Shriek's deal is, really. I'm neither here nor there on it. But that sounds like it's probably, I'm betting it's going to have a little bit of a Natural Born Killers vibe.
Yeah, that
should be
sense.
The Juliette Lewis to his, Woody Harrelson.
What if they cast Juliette Lewis? Okay, so I pulled up the Wikipedia because this character showed up in Spider-Man Unlimited number 1 in May 1993, co-created by Tom DeFalco, Mike W. Barr, Terry Cavanaugh, Ron Lim, Jerry Bingham, and Mark Bagley. There should not be that many characters.
Wow, so these were like everybody who was working on like the Clone Saga or something like that?
I like to think they were all in a room and they're like, what about Shriek?
You guys should really see this costume because she has big, big black hair. She has one buccaneer boot.
Yeah, she has one
buccaneer
boot.
And then one long boot. She's
mostly dressed in like black leather, though.
She looks like Lilith.
She has one armband. She's got like the mystique plunging bodysuit. This is a bad costume.
Yeah, but it's not so different from like, say, Celine from the Hellfire Club or something like that. It's just slightly more stylized.
Shriek, her origins were first unknown. She's named Sandra Deal.
Okay.
She was abused by her mother for being overweight, driving her to drugs, and leading her to a later fixation on becoming a mother herself. She became a drug dealer, which exposed her...
Wait, did you say a fixation on becoming a mother?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Let me finish this.
All right.
You gotta hear the whole thing. She became a drug dealer, which exposed her to situations that ultimately damaged her sanity. Namely, being shot in the head by a police officer, and being put in Cloak's Dark First Dimension, which awakened her latent mutant abilities.
Oh, so she's a mutant?
Apparently, yes.
I wonder if there's any possibility the movie might change any of that.
Oh my god.
No, this is where they introduce mutants. Shriek will be the first mutant.
You ready for that, Randy?
Sure,
this is the dark times. This is when the Balrog killed him.
Anyway, all I care about is them casting Juliette Lewis in this role. That
would be amazing.
But I do think Woody Harrelson playing off of another psychotic person as a co-star / lover sounds like fun.
He's certainly shown he can do it.
He's shown he can do it. Carnage should look entertaining on screen. They did a good job with the Venom effects. To some degree, when Zombieland 2 hits the next week, we'll get a little bit more of the sense of the director and see how he's doing lately.
Yeah.
I haven't been wowed by the trailers for that, but I want it to be good. Yeah. I enjoyed Zombieland. I'm ready for Shriek, I guess.
Speaking of 90s flashbacks... the Titans show, Jason Todd apparently was falling to his doom, and there was a poll as to whether or not he should live or die, as the viewers were ready to write in.
Yep.
The poll closed. It looks like he's going to live.
Oh, interesting.
51% by 51 to 49.
Now let's just quick do a little flashback for people who might not have been be aware of their comic history or been around in the 80s, but they did that. That's how he died originally.
Yeah.
They did a Joker beat him up with a crowbar. At the end of the issue, they're like, hey, viewers, call in with this number to this hotline, which will cost you like a buck, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, that's correct.
To vote. You have like, I believe it was like 24 or maybe 48 hours from the day that hit on the newsstands to do it. And he won, but it was like a difference of like a few hundred votes maybe, or maybe even less. And that was what ruled that he died, which, well, you know, created a long chain of events ultimately culminating in Red Hood and stuff like that.
And Tim Drake. I mean, no death of Jason Todd, probably no Tim Drake.
Yeah.
So I think one of our friends surmised that this was just a
gimmick.
Gimmick. that he was never going to die.
Right. The guess was that, like, how could they, in the middle of the season, which has to have a lot of other stuff filmed, you would think, can they do this unless there is some big gap?
Oh, was this not the end of the season?
No. No, this was mid-season. If he was, like, falling to his doom, the way they stop it is...
Unless it's going to happen, and then it's not key to the events that come afterwards, so they could do whatever it was and then come back round to it next season.
No, because the way it... Because the episode that they just aired finished that little thing, and it was the introduction of another character.
Like, it would be weird. Here's a question. Could Jason Todd be taken off the map and the season continue? Just as the story, could the storylines continue?
Can we find out later that whether he lived or died?
I guess you could have.
Because I do, that could be possible.
Yeah.
But his, that fall is the introduction to, I don't know. It's Connor Kent.
Okay.
And he basically saves Jason Todd.
Yeah, I heard you and Anna talking about that all morning.
From falling and basically introduces himself to the rest of the Titans.
So wait, he saved him?
Yeah.
So he can't die.
Well, you know, you can die from other ways than falling. That might have been the initial tease, but...
Well, I mean, he literally catches in midair and they both fall.
What if it wasn't to vote whether he survives the fall or not? Like, we're going to put a cliffhanger on... He almost dies every episode, and then in season three, you decide whether or not he lives or not.
Anna and I did joke that was going to how it's happening.
What if he
it's
saved like... him, and then the next episode just breaks his neck before he puts it down? No, wait a minute. Did they at the end of the episode say vote on the poll?
No.
That was just something you had to know about?
Yes. I didn't know about it until...
Did they just fix the poll?
That's what the thought is. Because, by the way, the original poll, by the way, was like one of those 49% to 51%.
Yeah.
It's weird that it duplicated it so closely.
Yeah. I think it was just a... look at us. Look at our sly nod to ourselves.
Maybe so. but do you think, though, Nick, that it had to be... That was that fall what the poll was all about?
I mean, I guess it had to have been.
But like, if they've already shown it...
They couldn't possibly have had any plans to do anything else. Unless they filmed two endings.
I guess
it's possible.
I guess, yeah, they could have filmed two endings.
Yeah, I guess they could have. It'd be weird, and I guess they
didn't
introduce
It's kind of weird that
Connor
they didn't
later.
Make more of a big deal about this.
Yeah.
Like, if we weren't enmeshed in comics and stuff, we wouldn't really know about it,
no.
I think. We barely heard about it.
Is it possible that the Titans show is not a big deal anymore? Nobody...
I mean, I have no idea, but it's at least, like, the kind of thing that I would have thought that DC would have promoted.
Yeah.
It's their own in-house streaming network.
Well, I will say, I have seen rumors that the Titans are going to be referenced on Crisis on Infinite Earths. They are going to show up briefly.
Well, everybody's going to show up on Crisis on Infinite Earths, including Knox.
Yes,
Alexander Knox. I saw this as I was scrolling through my news, and I reported in all caps on our podcast. I was like, holy shit, Knox is coming back.
I think we're all big Knox fans here.
Right. For those of you who are not born in the 80s or before, Knox is the reporter played by Robert Wool.
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
In Batman 89.
Yeah.
He was kind of an invented character for the movie, did not show up in the second one.
No, he didn't, but he was a goofy humor, too.
He was basically the reporter partnered with Vicki Vale.
Yeah. Their investigations provided sort of exposition, led the viewer into, if you didn't know who the whole deal on Batman and Bruce Wayne and stuff back then, you know, he would kind of like figure it out from there. And he was kind of comic relief.
Yeah.
He was a smartass.
Yep.
I kind of liked the character and always thought that it would have been kind of fun to go ahead and have him as a character in Batman comics.
And it's kind of a shame he didn't make his way to the animated series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because pretty much everybody else did. Like, Vicki Vale didn't either, did she?
No, she didn't.
I thought she showed once or twice.
I don't think she did.
I don't think she did.
Yeah. But by then, they were keying a little bit more off Batman Returns, and since neither of them were in that, maybe they didn't care at that point.
That's so weird.
It is weird. But yeah, I think I've heard, you know, this may be like the some of the most cameo of cameos, but like...
Well, you know what would be, the most interesting thing would be if he's the editor-in-chief over the Gotham paper and he like calls up Clark Kent, who is now editor-in-chief.
That'd be awesome. You know, of course, in the movie, he's the guy who's like the kind of the conspiracy theorist weirdo guy who people make fun of for chasing down the character called Batman and
all that stuff. He could be working at the Planet for all we know as a reporter. I mean, he could
be
their conspiracy guy or
have
their
you seen that there's,
affairs guy.
Have we, do we know if that phone news or like mock newspaper was a real thing that showed like it's like Bruce Wayne?
That's real.
Yeah, that's real. That's
Selena
part
Kyle.
Of it. That, that's
was
part
that
of
using
it.
Photos from back when? It
yes.
looked like young.
Yeah, it was
Bruce
Michael
Wayne.
Keaton and.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it is Infinite Earths.
Like, that could be up on the wall at, like, the Gotham Gazette or something like that.
They're clearly going to use the multiple Earths, which is kind of cool.
It is cool.
And also, you guys have seen Tom Cavanaugh's Pariah, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man, it looks great. I'm so excited for this.
Yeah. I'm not watching any of the CW shows right now, but I will turn in.
It's a big old five-part thing, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. Three
right?
parts in December, two parts in January.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. All right, moving on. This is a bit of... I don't know too much about this. The Jim Henson Company is developing something called Lore Olympus for Netflix Animated.
I did a bare bit of investigation. Lore Olympus is a webcomic.
Okay.
It's a webcomic, about Greek gods and stuff like that. But I forget what, like, the... Beyond that, I don't know what its deal is.
So, it says here, witness what the gods do after dark. The friendships and the lies, the gossips and the wild parties, and, of course, forbidden love. Because it turns out the gods aren't so different from us after all, especially when it comes to their problems. Stylish and immersive, this is one of mythology's greatest stories, the taking of Persephone, as it's never been told before.
Hmm. So, there's, like, Hades and Persephone?
I would guess, yeah.
That's interesting, because, you know, like, the Sunstone guy has been doing all these comic strips related to that.
Yeah.
I think, although, in the comics, or in the actual lore, like, it basically seems like a kind of rapey kidnapping. But it does seem like nowadays it's been turned around, at least by some writers. And I think even there's maybe certain versions of the myths you can find, I'm not 100% sure on this, where it does seem like it's a consensual thing, and I think people like the idea of their kind of, I mean, I hate to say like a Joker Harley thing, but it's like Hades as like one of the big gods, he actually does less bad stuff than like, say, Zeus does.
Well, I was going to say that it's all over Tumblr. I've seen all kinds of memes where basically Persephone is like the woman who sort of tamed Hades, basically. She is like, she is the goddess of spring and love, but it's also like the goddess of death now, and like, there's all these memes about like how she's crying, and Hades is like, what's wrong, my love? And she's like, she's trying to pet Cerberus. She's like, I have one too. I don't have enough hands.
Oh, yeah.
The notion of her sort of being the sweet...
Wasn't that from the Sunstone guy?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I saw some vignettes he did that were just like a one-page, like one-panel type things.
I saw it as a text thing.
Oh, interesting. I could swear I've seen an illustrated version by Stepan Sedgwick.
We should have a T-shirt that says Hades is right. Hades was right.
I've seen a ton of memes.
But at the very least, it's clearly kind of become a bit of a pop cultural thing out in Tumblr land, Instagram land, etc.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's kind of interesting. Now, the sort of After Dark makes it sound like it's some kind of going to be like the CW style.
It says young adult.
Like so Riverdale-ish?
CW, I would think that's probably about right.
Riverdale. Now, but Jim Henson, does that mean they're going to be Muppets?
No, animated.
Oh, animated.
Yeah,
okay.
Henson does animation as well.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, that sounds kind of cool.
Yeah.
All right, there were a couple trailers we watched. There's Jungle Cruise, Disney's Jungle Cruise, which has The Rock and Emily Blunt.
Yep.
Seems like a period piece about a Jungle Cruise, and she's a treasure hunter of some kind.
Yeah, after some sort of secret...
Well, it's clear that basically The Rock is like the tour guide through this Jungle Cruise of dangers, stages false dangers, like headhunters are attacking, and they're like, you see him hanging out with them later on and stuff like that. And only to, of course, take her on this mission and, I guess, get into real dangers and stuff like that.
It felt very mummy-ish.
Yeah, it did.
A little more overtly slapsticky.
Yeah.
I was not loving it, although... After sort of Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, I'm kind of at least open to the idea. The Rock is super fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, The Rock is very endearing. So.
I'd like for it to be good. I fell in love with Emily Blunt once again during the trailer.
Sure.
Even though the movie looks lame to me.
it doesn't look great to me. And I feel like...
I don't know if I'll go see it in theaters unless I hear the buzz is good, but I'll probably check it out.
I might go see it with my free Alamo Pass.
Oh, somebody thinks he's something now. Gonna have to knock you down a peg with murder.
Huh. Well,
I told you it was gonna be a bitter podcast, Randy.
Does that mean I get his Alamo Pass?
Yep.
Okay.
But you want to go see the Jungle Cruise with me?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, but you're gonna bring me along. You're gonna weekend at Bernie's this whole thing.
We can do that.
They do check your ID.
Yeah.
So we're gonna definitely have to weekend at Bernie's, or Randy.
Yeah. Do they really check your ID?
They have when I've gone.
Even if you're using the app?
Yes.
Interesting.
They want to make sure it lines up, that you're not scamming them or whatever.
Okay.
Now, I don't know, maybe after a while they'll stop doing that, but I think there's once or twice when they haven't, but I got the vibe those were the nights that they were, like, super busy.
Yeah.
I feel like most of the time they do.
Interesting. I just want to know, if we're doing Weekend at Bernie's, Am I Jonathan Silverman or am I the other guy?
Andrew McCarthy.
Andrew McCarthy.
I've never watched Weekend at Bernie's.
You're Andrew McCarthy. Dave is Jonathan Silverman.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I'm Bernie the Corpse.
Is this good or bad for me? Have I been insulted?
No.
Okay.
No. You're the practical one.
Yeah, I was gonna say you're the practical one.
Nick
and
is the wild one with the crazy plans. You're the one who just murders me, and Nick is the one with like, hey, let's take his corpse and Alamo.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
To the movies.
Randy, start working on your kind of like off-center smile.
I already have.
Yeah, you're ready to Bernie it.
The other trailer is Doolittle. Robert Downey Jr. is following up the acclaimed run as Iron Man with this weird as hell period piece with talking animals thing that I can only assume he's doing because of his kids. It's got a huge cast, like Marion Cotillard is in there.
Antonio Banderas.
Like, there's a ton of people in this. It looks terrible to me.
I thought that's weird that so many people are saying that, because I thought it looked like it had a little bit of mythic vision to it.
I would want to see Cats more than I want to see this.
Oh, wow. Same. Bold words. I already wanted to see Cats.
Yeah, I did too.
But it wasn't grabbing me, but... I thought, like, his performance looked good. I suspect the period piece thing is just because it's probably taken from... They're probably trying to go closer to the original book that it was based on. Not that I've read it.
It was weird. Did Robert Downey Jr., like, use a different accent? Like, his affectation was kind of...
He was using a weird affected accent.
Hello, I'm Dr. Doolittle.
I don't think it was exactly like that, but you're close.
Right, watch the trailers and people and compare it right up against what I said and see if it's not really close, though.
Next week, we're going to have Dave reread all the dialogue from the trailer in that voice. So you can fully compare
that trailer will be three times longer than it was before I'm done with it.
Anyway, I
don't think either any of us are like way looking forward to any either of these movies.
No.
But
I will take Jungle Cruise over Robert Downey Jr. plays with CGI animals.
Same. Well, I hate to say that I will take Robert Downey Jr. plays with CGI animals over your shitty Jungle Cruise, but I guess true. I will.
Yep, that's the hell you're going to die on.
I guess.
And since we are, in as always...
A binary.
No, it's a left-right thing.
That's left-right.
Someone left-right, someone in the center. I will be in the center not watching either of these pieces of shit.
I've always thought of you as a centrist, Randy.
Zoe Kravitz has been cast to play Catwoman in The Batman. Mm-hmm.
Somebody tell me about Zoe Kravitz, because I haven't seen her in anything.
She was recently in...
Daughter of Lenny, I assume.
Yes. Yeah. She was recently in Big Little Lies. She's in both seasons of that.
Right.
No, she was in the second season. No, both seasons. She was really good in it. But she was also in, like, High Fidelity.
No, not High Fidelity. She would have been, like, a fetus.
Is that Lisa Bonet?
Oh, that was Lisa Bonet, sorry.
She does have a certain similar look.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
I forget exactly what else Zoe Kravitz has been in.
I looked it up earlier and I've forgotten, but she's good. I like her.
She is good.
And she'll be a good Catwoman. She voiced Catwoman in the Lego movie. Lego Batman movie.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah.
All right. I don't have any strong opinions on her one way or the other. I don't know if this is Internet Tempest in a Teapot. Of course, there's some racist shit.
Yeah.
I haven't heard enough about this to see whether that's making any sort of rounds or if it's really just a few trolls
always expect. Probably just a few trolls.
I kind of feel like since people were already scared off by Robert Pattinson a little bit, and I think I think that casting a African American woman as Catwoman is probably not going to shock anybody more or less at this point. At the very least. People can point out that in the Batman 66, Eartha Kitt was the first black Catwoman a zillion years ago.
Yep.
We all kind of try and forget that Halle Berry, too, was.
Yeah.
But that also occurred.
Yep.
Maybe that will be one of the startling things in the multiverse crossover.
If Halle Berry came as Catwoman, that'd be amazing.
I mean, I gotta
say, give her props for that, actually.
That would be a great one to keep under wraps, to have a little bit of tongue-in-cheek fun with, and then just move on.
I hope you're right. I hope that happens.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that one, but it would be hilarious.
What would be amazing is if Michael Keaton returned as old man Bruce Wayne.
That would be the greatest thing, and a friend of mine, when I posted the thing about Knox, said, I hope that they don't reveal everything, and, like, that would be one to sit on.
Yeah.
I would sit on that and then do Batman Beyond.
Yeah.
And with him as
Batman.
That'd
be amazing, and I could see it.
All he has to do is come in and film a couple days worth for his scenes.
Couple hours.
I'm getting more excited for the Batman movie, though. I think Robert Pattinson is going to do really well.
I think it's going to have some potential. Like, it's weird to, like, get excited for a new Batman movie. We've seen a lot of them.
I'm more sensing this one than anything else DC has going except for Suicide Squad.
Yeah. Not Wonder Woman 84?
Oh, right. Yeah, you're right.
I want to see a trailer for that. I need something to kind of go on.
The delay makes me nervous.
Yeah.
The 1 year delay makes me really nervous.
But I feel
nervous.
Like that was because they were all hinging it on Flashpoint.
Maybe so.
And they were like,
this is going to happen.
Yeah. I guess we shouldn't have moved it back, but we can't move it up.
What's the Flashpoint
thing? They were supposed to be doing Flashpoint.
Yeah, and then all the Flashpoints fell through.
Oh, the Flash movie was going to be the Flashpoint time thing. Okay, yeah. I wonder if it's also possible that once James Gunn got on board, they were like, we could give this guy a prominent role and let him be a big part of sort of a new rollout, a soft reboot of DC.
Yeah.
And that we think is going to go over much better than Flashpoint.
It's possible.
All right. I guess we'll find out.
Last bit of news. The Matrix 4 continues to cast. They have cast Neil Patrick Harris in some kind of secret role.
Which is weird. Neil Patrick Harris in the Matrix.
Neil Patrick Harris. He's a funny guy.
Yeah.
He throws himself into the roles that he plays.
Yeah.
So.
What was the one that... who's the guy who oversees everything? Will Ferrell spoofed him. Yeah, the architect.
Yeah.
He's going to play the architect.
Oh, my God.
He'll play the architect junior.
Please don't have the architect in the Matrix 4.
I also would like to vote against the architect. I don't know if the Wachowskis can possibly make this happen again.
I don't know either.
But
after Sense8,
yeah.
Like, I feel like Sense8 was great. Maybe
is that a special
it.
Collaboration with JMS? Like, do they need to work with JMS from here on?
Oh, that'd be good. JMS bring something to the Matrix.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, JMS did that book on Superman and his connection to the character.
Oh, yeah.
I listened to a BBC interview the other day on the radio. That was like a 20-minute interview with him where he talked about his rough childhood. It is crazy dark.
Yeah, okay.
Abusive dad, prostitute mother.
Wow.
Just endless darkness in his life. And Superman was like the one point of light that he tried to like sort of model himself on, as well as trying to model himself on everything his dad didn't do.
Huh.
Anyway, it's interesting. It's an interesting interview. It kind of made me curious about the book. But if nothing else, I'm sure people could just type in BBC and J. Michael Straczynski and just catch that interview. It's just interesting to see a bit behind the guy who's done a lot of comics, too.
Yeah. All right, that's news for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, October 16th, and it's actually October 15th as we record this, because technically, at October 16th, 12:01 a.m., all these comics are going on sale.
It's true.
That is in... two short hours?
Yep. Eight.
Yeah, 2 short hours. From now.
From now.
Not as you're listening. As you're listening, it's probably been a long time.
Yeah.
Long time passed.
We're all very much asleep by now.
Yes.
Except Nick, who had to be here again in the morning, because God hates Nick.
Yep, that's true. He does. It's okay, though. But Randy, what is your pick?
Nick loves X-Men.
That's true.
So I feel like you're the one who's most excited to be here, and therefore should be punished.
That's true.
Okay,
that's what you get for reading Hickman books.
My pick is Superman Smashes the Klan Part 1. This is a new format. It's like a little mini graphic novel.
It's digest size.
It's $8. It's digest size.
But it's not like the babiest of digests.
No.
It's like a big boy digest.
It's got a spine. It's probably like 8
pages.
It's
like the current Marvel, the Marvel stuff they're reprinting.
Yeah, the big
section.
Miles Morales reprints and all that.
It's a cool format, and it is written by Gene Lin Wang, who has done New Superman and a few other things. That was one thing I really liked from him, is New Superman. And the artist by Guri Hiro, which is a husband and wife team who have done things like Power Pack and Gwenpool.
They are great at animated style art.
Yep.
Like, if you wanted to kind of look cartoony, and this reminded me more than anything, by the way, of the look of the Iron Giant.
Yeah.
So if you like how the Iron Giant is animated, then you're probably going to like this.
I think I just want to say, all three of us really liked this book.
Oh, yeah.
And it's based on an old 1940s...
It's based on a 1940s story Gene Lin Wang talks about in the back, that basically it was like he was reading comics, and that basically Superman was having a throwdown. There was a Chinese immigrant, and he's like, I never saw Chinese characters in comics, and that they were... that the fake Ku Klux Klan was fighting Superman, the Klan of the Fiery Cross, which is funny because...
A sort of invented...
In 1946, doing an anti-KKK story was pretty out there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he was doing a a sort of modern revision of it. This takes place in 1946 in Metropolis.
Yeah. Right, a modern-day revision, but set in the same era in which the story was conceived.
Superman opens by fighting a Nazi. There's the discovery of kryptonite, which has not been discovered. Superman does not yet know he's Kryptonian, which is going to be revealed in the series.
It was actually like kind of interesting because, like, although there's a kind of an all-ages quality to this, like in the Iron Giant with some sophistication, he takes down this like kind of Nazi supervillain, and then he's like feeling like really sick because the guy had this kryptonite, which he hadn't uncovered yet. Yep. And he's not sure what's going on. And it was actually kind of interesting. It's interesting how sort of threatening they make it.
What's funny is this is not that much of a Superman story. I mean, he's had it, he's through it throughout. But really, this is the story of this Chinese-American family that has moved to Metropolis. They have been living in Metropolis, Chinatown. There's a wife who is sort of not quite assimilated. She's speaking Chinese. Her husband, who is taking over as the, like, is he the microbiologist?
Yep.
Yeah, for the health department. He is very much trying to assimilate.
They were moving. They were living in the Chinatown section of Metropolis. And so now they're moving to like sort of like out of there, and they're kind of hitting culture shock.
They're moving to the big city, and the dad is kind of he's trying to assimilate. He's a scientist. His son is the all-American baseball player, and his daughter is sort of, she's a little nervous and is having trouble fitting in. And it's they befriend Jimmy Olsen, who lives next door, which I thought was a really clever little bit to tie them in. And they have some run-ins with this kid who's maybe a little bit racist. And his dad, more than a little bit racist, because he's in the KKK.
Uh-huh.
Or I don't think it's his dad, I think it's his uncle.
It's his uncle.
But, there's some interesting stuff in here, because it's also, like, flashing back to Superman discovering his powers, doing a sort of origin-type thing.
It's like, I feel like the writer, Gene Wang, that he took the story and he kind of expanded it in such a way that it almost, in its way, sort of opens up like another sort of little Superman universe.
Yeah.
It's a weird, not like a retelling of his origin, but it does kind of like, it's a rethink of it, in a really strong way.
There's great characters, there's fun dialogue. I love the period piece elements of it. The art is fantastic. This was really, really good. I was looking forward to it, and it delivered on every page.
I like the characters. I like his take on Lois and Jimmy, and the relationship between the brother and sister really sells it for me.
Yeah, for sure. Dave?
So my pick this week is something oddball for me. It's a issue of the Orville comic.
I'm not going to say that's super oddball. You love Star Trek. You love the Orville.
Right, but I'm like I hadn't even seen the second season of the Orville. Just bits and pieces. But I don't have Hulu or whatever it's on. I need to steal somebody's password. anyway, I had actually missed the previous issue, which they've been doing these little two-part stories. And I really... They've been good. It's one of the show's writers who does it. David Goodman, I think. And... I guess in two issues is actually surprisingly just about right to do what would feel like a regular episode of the show. I think sometimes we would get, you would get one-shots in comics that feel a little too short for that, or they'd do a five-part or six-part storyline that feels too bloated. Two issues felt just about right for me, and it's a cool story. So for those who follow the Orville, aka Seth MacFarlane's Star Trek knockoff, this starts with a great little scene on what there is their holodeck. Where they're recreating this, like, battle in... who is it? It's Gordon and... who's the other guy? Malloy.
Yep.
It's like in the Battle of the Knights Templar versus the Islamic King Saladin.
Yeah.
And hilariously, they don't really, like, they're like, why are we fighting these guys again? It's before the big Braveheart charge.
They're like, they worship different gods, right? And it's like, no, I think they worship the same gods.
Same gods, different prophet. and right before they go in, Gordon's, like, rallying thing to his group as he's like, all right, you guys, let's kill those other guys who believe in exactly the same god that we do, but differently. And that really annoys us. And then they're all like, yay!
I think the big thing for this is they get the voices.
Oh, yeah. Every time, like, I hadn't watched the show in a while, but as soon as I started reading it, I was hearing it, everything in the sounds of the various voices.
Yes, completely.
So this is an interesting callback. So there's an episode, a few in the first season, where the captain, Captain Mercer, and Malloy. Gordon.
Or Gordon, yeah.
Where is it, Malloy?
No, it's Gordon.
I missed those guys. I mixed those guys up.
Is it Gordon Malloy?
I think it's Gordon Malloy. I think we're both actually right.
You guys are conflating.
Okay.
Yes.
Anyway, where they went undercover with the Krill, a.k.a. their Klingons,
yep.
who are portrayed as kind of like religious extremists, right?
Yep.
And
they worship a god.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And they actually like stole a like sort of their Bible, Quran, kind of equivalent. So that because the Union, the what are they called?
Is it not the Union?
It's the Union, but there's like the full thing is like the Space Union or something like that. But I can't remember what it is. Anyway, they
it's the Federation.
The Union Federation.
The Union Federation.
Although, you know, they were going undercover, I think specifically to steal this, the idea was to better understand them. You know, it was not like wholly an act of aggression. And what happens in this is they stop a ship that's about to go going into the Krill zone that looks like it's, you know, almost like on a suicide run, like anybody who goes in there is gonna end up potentially killed. Only it turns out that the people on board that ship were scientists, the very scientists who were studying the religious artifact, and have kind of taken up the belief system of the Krill. So they're mostly human, one or two aliens in there, and an ex kind of Lamar. An ex of his from that he knew like at the academy, who he's got like a sort of an interest in, and he's like, "This is really weird. You know, you are a very sharp person. How did you fall into this?"
Yeah.
And there's some interesting stuff, and there's some nuance to it because it's not like a trick or anything. Like she really did get into it. She's like, "I went through some rough times. I have, you know, kind of actually." Kept having trouble with jobs after the academy, and this gave me some stability in my life and a sense of, like, you know, understanding life. And they are actually just trying to get to the Krill. They unfortunately have also sort of sabotaged the ship that so that the Orville, by the end of the first issue, ends up directly in Krill space. And that was last issue. And this issue is all about what happens when they are trapped in Krill space with a bunch of people who want to defect, essentially, to them. And so there's some interesting discussion of religious stuff, religious freedom. Like
there's some cool action sequence in it.
There's actually a super cool action sequence that has to do with, like, they took what's kind of a common idea, which is, like, cloaking the ship, another thing with an asteroid belt, but they did something really cool with it. And there's some twists and turns that I was like, ah, this is, like, when the show is kind of at its best, when Mercer is kind of like Kirk was, kind of working like a kind of a wild gambit, a risky thing to make something happen. I really enjoyed like every page of it.
Yeah.
And I found in some ways I was probably laughing more than I was at the show sometimes.
I think it's easy to write the Orville off. I think people hear Seth MacFarlane and think Family Guy, but the show and these comics actually deal with some pretty big ideas.
It matured surprisingly fast, even in the first season. And I know from what y'all have told me that the second season definitely took a jump past that.
Yeah. I mean, so it's not above some fart jokes.
Right.
I mean, it's
still
Seth MacFarlane. And weirdly enough, most of those land. They're funny.
The vibe that somebody once described it, and I'm sure I probably mentioned this before when we were just talking about Orville as a show, was that it feels a little bit like a group of gamers playing a Star Trek game. They're playing jerk-offs like players are sometimes. Yep. And the DM is kind of like, or the GM is just kind of rolling with it. And he's like letting them be goofy, but every once in a while he gets the plot back on track.
Yeah.
That's what the Orville feels like. And this was a super awesome one. One thing I noticed was that there's some swearing in this that is not normally present in the show, just once or twice, but somebody drops the F-bomb at one point.
Yep.
And it was actually at a point that was completely appropriate. And you pointed out to me, Nick, that it's moving to Hulu. And I suspect it's going to get a slightly edgier rating. It's going to go up to PG-13, or at least R in the language, maybe. I bet the rest of it is more or less the same.
PG-13, you're allowed one F-bomb, I believe.
I don't know, does that work on TV shows? They should do it like that.
I mean, I feel like it is. I feel like...
Yeah. But if you like the show, I would say this is like, you should pick this up when it hits in graphic novel, or just grab the last two storylines, this two-parter. It's issues 3 and 4 of the series. The art was good throughout, the artist captured everybody's look, so... Right. Yeah, I was not planning to enjoy this, and instead, I was like, I'm just going to catch up randomly, and I liked it so much, it's my pick. All right, Nick, why don't you bring it home by telling us about the very reason we're here tonight.
Exactly. The reason we're here tonight is X-Men #1.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, I
you love... have my favorite cover of it there, by the way.
Yeah, the cover I chose, which there are many covers to choose, especially some, like, the ones we only got one of, like the Russell Datterman, but this is the Art Room cover that features Marvel Girl dressed in her... Where did we determine? It was like the it's 60s? Not
her very, it is 60s, but it was like her late 60s. It, like, when she originally began, she had a blue and yellow costume like all the X-Men. Yeah. But at some point, they got slightly newer looks, and Cyclops got his, like, Buccaneer boots. Angel got that kind of ugly yellow cross-suit costume with the crisscross harness.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And she got the sort of the red skirt and yellow kind of headpiece thing, whatever you call those.
The green skirt.
Green skirt, yeah, jeez.
Green skirt and kind of a yellow mask.
Yeah.
With the Wolverine.
Yeah, the Wolverine points to him.
Wolverine points. So, yeah. Hickman has sort of built up a new X-Men world.
Yep. It's interesting that that's a throwback costume, but the comic is much more about moving the X-Men forward to a completely, really completely new place.
Well, I will say Hickman is taking kind of a Morrison approach. He just did a Q&A that he released through, I forget if it was CBR or some big one. And he was saying that there's a reason why she's in that outfit, and people haven't surmised it yet. And he was like, I thought you guys would get that, but I'm not going to reveal it now.
Like, it could be this is the clone gene from this original team, or there's going to be some reason.
But, so this is sort of the beginning of the new... It's second page, they call it, it's a Brave New World. And that's sort of what it is. Mutants have a place to live, and that's not just... your X-Men. This is every mutant has a place that they can come to and be sort of free.
This is the island of Krakoa that was heavily featured throughout House of X and Powers of X.
So
is Krakoa sentient?
I was gonna say, having not read all of Hawks and Pox, all I remember of Krakoa is he was the island that tried to eat all the X-Men.
Correct. Yeah. Xavier sort of came to a understanding with it. Yes, he gave him a Snickers. He was angry.
The psychic Snickers.
And he gave him a psychic Snickers.
I think we have our title.
No, he did not give him a psychic Snickers, but he did make friends with him, and then he brought Cypher to the island, and Cypher was able to talk to him.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
It was a cool idea, and it made Cypher more important, and actually...
I remember the scene, I read the scene where Cypher is figuring it out, and you hear him kind of talking to himself as he goes through, like, oh, right, he wouldn't have, like, such kind of... He wouldn't use compound words. He would be doing this. And
he asked Xavier to do, like, get him to think about something else, and that allowed him to understand more about Krakoa. So, yeah, honestly, Hickman has made Cypher, like, super important because they wouldn't have Krakoa without him.
Right.
Which is really cool, actually.
Writers always had a tough time with Cypher, and if nothing else, I gotta give Hickman credit for figuring out a good use for him.
But this book is the X-Men, and I think we're gonna get a rotating group of characters, because this is gonna feature everyone. But this first issue deals with a lot of, like, the core characters. It has Cyclops, Storm, Magneto, Wolverine, pretty much every person of the Summers clan.
I saw Magneto has built up a cult of personality. The kids on the island you're the coolest.
Yeah, he's become like a god in a lot of ways.
And he has enough ego to kind of embrace it.
Yeah, but he's also not, like, evil at the moment.
Right.
He's actually kind of enjoying this sort of... I mean, he cares about mutants. I think he always has to some degree. I mean, he's killed millions of humans, because why not?
Have you killed millions of humans?
I don't think millions, but I definitely remember him killing people.
Yeah.
Like, people in the ships that he picked up during Claremont's X-Men.
Yeah, there's been submarines and ships and at least one city attack, so he's done some damage.
But, you know... then Genosha was killed, and he feels like he's a little bit...
I was going to say, I feel a little bit nervous about hanging out on a mutant island after Genosha.
Well, and that is addressed. Hickman does address that, which is interesting.
He's like, we set up guards on the coast. We're watching for giant sentinels that'll kill us all.
But I don't think Genosha was ever sort of, like, recognized by the U.S. government, or by governments in general.
They were like a terrorist nation.
Yeah, they were a terrorist nation. This Xavier is sort of set up, like... you know, trading and things like that.
Right, they're a sovereign nation.
Exactly.
Yeah, that has, like, and Nick, I never saw whether it fully came to fruition, but I guess it must have, the idea that Krakoa would offer people sort of trade and sort of its mutant, like, seeds that had, like, the ability to, like, grow where other things couldn't grow. And
I think, basically it produced three different drugs that enhanced... Basically gave humans 5 years of extra life, basically destroyed cancers and, like, things of the brain, like diseases of the brain, so like Alzheimer's and things like that. And one other one, I can't remember what it did.
We're going to find out that Krakoa has actually been slowly training people, like having them ingest bits of itself so that it can take them over, like in a couple years.
That would be weirdly like the stuff. That would be strange.
Yeah.
Does anyone know if Jonathan Hickman was a huge fan of the movie The Stuff?
It's possible.
If you know if Jonathan Hickman is a huge fan of The Stuff, please send to the store an email with the subject line reading, Jonathan Hickman was a huge fan of The Stuff.
Or if you're familiar with the movie The Stuff, please send us an email saying, yes, I have seen The Stuff.
Man, I've lost my train of thought on
that. I'm sorry, Nick. I didn't mean to.
You bring up The Stuff. We're going to talk about The Stuff.
I know.
Tell us about some other interesting scenes in there.
Well, House of X and Powers of Ten were very kind of weirdly time-jumpy and a little bit giant ideas spread out through issues. This is very straightforward. This is basically an X-Men team going after, what are they called? Sort of a base of...
I was trying to figure out who are the threats going to be if all of the formerly evil mutants have kind of been given something like amnesty.
And I think that is the case, but that probably will not last.
Yeah.
But right now they're up against Orcus, which is the weird sort of government organization that's composed of, like, S.H.I.E.L.D., AIM...
you said government.
Strike.
They're not like a U.S. government thing.
No, no, they're sort of an offshoot.
Okay.
But they're composed of S.H.I.E.L.D., AIM,
Hydra.
Hydra, because they mentioned like Project Paperclip and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like that always happens, and you have to have a little bit of Hydra. but this is basically a strike force going after kind of a base of Orcus.
And well, what does Orcus like want to do?
Kill mutants. They are sort of like the creator of this new breed of Sentinels and things like that. And they're also sort of like gathering mutants to kill them, essentially, and learn from their kind of autopsy kind of stuff.
Yep.
And this is the X-Men going after one of them and trying to save mutants, which, as an opening story, is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get to see the X-Men do some action.
That's a little
things.
Of a everything old is new again, which Morrison also did a version of, because he had people doing, like, skin grafts and stuff from mutants, and they were trying to sort of capture them for that.
But this also, the team that's there is led by Cyclops, and it's Cyclops being the leader again, and like classic.
Also working tightly, I saw alongside Storm
and Polaris.
He may be leader. Yeah, Polaris seemed to be in an elevated role, but also working closely alongside her dad, Magneto, which I guess that means they're now canonically back.
It's officially that she's his daughter again.
Okay,
which I think
Magneto's kids is the most retcon. Like I thought maybe.
Well, that
like,
was from House of M, right?
I don't.
That was where that was finally kind of Bendis, kind of did that.
Did Bendis make Polaris her? There was a point at which Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver were not his kids,
right,
and Polaris was.
Yes, and I don't know if it's Polaris is just his kid, and Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are not. So
I will say this:
really weird.
Hickman is pretty much been given the keys to the kingdom. If he says that Polaris is the daughter, that's going to stick.
Yeah, and I actually like it. Their relationship is interesting.
Yeah,
she's
always felt a little unfocused as a character to me. I hate to say it, but she's kind of always been Havoc's girlfriend, and I've never quite known what her own deal is. I guess in the late 80s, early 90s. Like, she had a fair amount of decent role to play in the X-Men.
Yeah.
But I don't, at least, I guess I didn't read a ton of that, so I don't have a good sense of
her. She was in
the
Op-X stuff, and then where I knew her most, I mean, I read the Op-X stuff, was X-Factor.
Yeah.
When Peter David came on and sort of gave her more of a personality and wasn't just Havoc's girlfriend.
But it's interesting to see her. She's clearly going to be a bit more of a spotlight.
There's a new character that Hickman throws in here that I don't know. It's definitely a little Easter egg for something that's going to be a big thing later on in his run. And then
what is it?
I don't know the character. she's new.
Oh.
And then we get back to Krakoa and sort of get to see some of the kind of downtime, which is always cool for the X-Men to see the downtime.
Yep. Do they play baseball?
They do not play baseball.
Do they play basketball?
They do have like a cookout. Which is kind of cool.
That's all right. No sports, though.
I will say, I was surprised to see
Kid Vulcan is making steaks, and he overcooks Wolverine's steak.
That's true.
You know, Wolverine's the best there is at what he does, but what he does is not cook steaks.
I was kind of happy to see a character that I thought was long lost to Extreme X-Men, which was Dr. Cecilia Reyes.
Oh, wow, I love her.
I know, it was kind of cool to see her back. And a couple of other people show up, which I was really surprised. And then it's all about Cyclops and sort of his connection with his family.
He hangs out with Corsair a bit.
Which just is cool. Yeah. I like seeing that relationship. We get some more with the villains, but I like the downtime. There's a scene with Rachel Gray and Hepzibah, which I think is a really cool scene.
Corsair's whole crew is kind of hanging out with hanging out with them.
Raza is there, Chad is there, and they each get their little moment. And I like all those people, and those characters are fun.
So you think pretty good first issue?
I think it is a good first issue.
Let's talk about Lanil Yu's art real quick.
Yeah, I'm not the hugest fan of Lanil Francis Yu's art, but here I think it is very, very good.
He's a pretty good artist.
He is very good. The one thing that
did
he
draw that Superman that was Mark Waid's revamp from years ago?
I don't remember.
I think it was Lanil Yu.
Which one?
Superman, the Mark Waid one.
He did Birthright.
Birthright.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The last thing I remember him drawing that I really, really enjoyed, there was a Civil War, it was during Secret War.
It was Secret War, Civil War.
And it was really amazing. Good.
Yeah.
And he's doing some pretty good stuff here.
He's sort of in the middle of there, and I like some of the character designs he does. They all feel very classic. Havoc has his giant hoops back, which I'm always excited about. There are infographics, so if you like infographics, you will not be... there's two people sitting at this table that hate infographics. And then Hickman teases of what's to come, basically, with some villain stuff. Kind of shadowy stuff in the background.
I'll have to ask you about that off mic, Nick, later on.
And then, yeah. So it seems like we've got a checklist of things to come, and we're going to get an X book a week, and sometimes two a week.
Interesting.
Next week is Marauders, which will be interesting, because that is going to be all about the...
Pirates
on the South Sea and Hellfire Trading Company, and...
I'm actually excited about Marauders.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of prepared not to like this in some ways. I'm like, okay, Hickman can do House of X and Power of X. Will he find kind of a balance of doing just like
a traditional
X-Men book? And I think he's kind of leaning into what he did with Fantastic Four.
Mm-hmm.
And building up the sort of family and the dynamics. And I ultimately don't remember who the villain was in his FF run. So I don't know
if
that... It was
the Council of Reeds, wasn't it?
Oh, it was the Council of Reeds. Which is not a strong villain for me, but... No. This one...
And he's a strong villain. Annihilus. Don't wreck ya.
I'll be curious to see where he goes with the villains in this, because, like you said, right now it's very one-note. Mm. And I don't think that is going to be...
Well, I don't know if I'd say one-note. I just meant that he's... You know, I love Morrison's run, but Morrison was... He was kind of doing a spin on some classic X-Men tropes, but it was like his spin was such a unique voice... that it might as well have been a new era, you know, so that I don't see that as a pejorative thing.
One thing I was very interested by was that Xavier doesn't show up in this.
Oh.
So this is all
that's
sort
good.
Of...
Cyclops needs some screen time.
Everyone thinks he's just a punk. No one likes Cyclops.
I think there are definitely Cyclops fans out there. If you're a Cyclops fan, please send us
a Cyclops fan.
I am a Cyclops fan, too.
All right, well, send us a message, guys.
Yeah, send us an email. I have seen the stuff and or I am a Cyclops fan.
Or you could say you're a Havoc fan, and I will like you because I've always liked Havoc more.
Nick, do you have some other comics to mention this week?
I do. Just a couple. I want to mention Something is Killing the Children.
Something is Killing the Children.
Oh, man, that was a really good issue.
Number two. This is a book I don't know where they're going. I mean, I could take some guesses, but it is a bizarre, wonderful, violent... Yeah.
It began with a kid in the first issue... who, like, thought he, like, dreamt a thing about, like, a monster in the backyard.
Yep.
But then months, or, like, a few weeks later, lots of kids are missing, and their bodies are found, or whatever.
It's like his friends, like, at a party.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the very end of the first issue, this woman showed up. I couldn't tell her age. Is she, like, late teens?
Yeah, I would say late teens, maybe early 20s.
Maybe early 20s. Who almost had that Slayer vibe, like Buffy, as in. Huh. And who was like, we know, you know, like, I know what's going on and we got to get to work. And so this issue focuses on exclusively on that in a very conversational way.
Now, on that character, but also introduces a sort of older brother of one of the kids that are missing.
I thought it was neatly introduced where you found out, you saw everything from his perspective, and then he was working at a restaurant, clearly an Applebee's.
Yeah.
where they go to make their plans, and she's like, almost nobody comes here to these places anymore. They'll be gone in a few years.
They have it's big
perfect.
Tables.
And they have big tables. It's a perfect place to do our planning. And Nick, you were saying, and you were right, that the dialogue is so good in
yeah.
it.
Yeah. James Tynion has sort of got this conversational...
Oh, that's Tynion?
Yeah. Huh? Very conversational style that just kind of... It reads well.
It will ease you into it. Like, the plot sounds a little... like monstrous and grotesque, but largely this issue was a conversation, and that could have gone so wrong. It could have been so boring,
yeah.
but every page I was like, oh, this is interesting. What's going to happen next? What are they talking about?
And it was
super interesting.
The art by Werther Deldera.
Great art. I don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we talked about that it looks a little Tim Sale-ish, which is the still
yep.
agree.
Yep. Tim Great. Sale, as it was like kind of as his art is sort of watercolor painted in the Marvel color series, like Spider-Man Blue, Daredevil Yellow,
Great monster designs. But read Something is Killing the Children.
Yeah, that is like definitely, I think, a easily recommended book right now.
Yeah. Also, another number one hitting tomorrow is Tales from the Dark Multiverse. This one is Batman Nightfall. Think of these... I mean, if you read Metal, you know what the Dark Multiverse is. It's a place
yep.
where the worst possible outcomes will always come to pass. So prepare for some darkness. This is actually written by Scott Snyder. Scott Snyder and Kyle Higgins, and art by Javier Fernandez. This takes place of, like, what if... Jean-Paul Valley never gave up the mantle of Batman. That he was able basically to stop Batman from taking the mantle back, and he basically molds Gotham in his image.
That sounds great.
yeah. I mean, it's a totalitarian
regime.
But that
sounds kind
of
fun. Nick, you likened it to an Elseworlds, and
yeah.
said it's got some of those same pleasures.
There's
oh,
some,
yeah.
There's
it
some
doesn't sound bad creatively. It just sounds like not good for Gotham.
Oh, no, no. I would not want to live here. that would be sad. But as an Elseworlds, it's a really cool idea. These sort of openings... part of it, there's something kind of like a monitor, but it's like a dark multiverse monitor. It's weird.
Hmm.
It's like looking at different worlds to find like something that will be hopeful in this world of just sadness.
Okay, that sounds kind of interesting.
But like I said, there's some really cool ideas in this. The art is wonderful. I think if you liked Metal or any of the stuff with the Batman Who Laughs, this is going to be up your alley. And
okay.
then I've got just a couple more. Batman number 81. We basically see Batman coming back to Gotham fighting Bane, drawn by John Romita Jr. Guardians of the Galaxy number 10.
I need to catch up on that.
The remainder of the Guardians convince a young Magus to join their team to fight the Universal Truth. Church of
That book is weird.
It is really weird, but it's very interesting.
Yeah.
If I stay behind in it though, tell me if Star Fox shows up again.
I will tell you if Star
he manages
Fox...
to be resurrected. Seems possible.
It does seem possible. And Rocket Raccoon is in a giant mech suit, which is kind of interesting.
That's very fitting.
And then my last one I have is Absolute Carnage number 4, which Donny Cates is doing the ultimate Metal Carnage story that there ever could be.
Right, but for a very Metal story, it has some depth, a little bit of depth.
It has a little bit more depth. I think
But it doesn't shy away from really allowing the artist to do some of the coolest shit in it.
That's true, but I will also say that Donny Cates has given more character to Eddie Brock than I think any other writer.
Yeah.
Without,
I think, like, making it feel like he's trying to change his course or do something
no,
really weird.
No, but it's like
him.
He's at a depth to him that I don't think Eddie has ever had.
Right.
I mean, there's just more that drives him as
yep.
as a character.
And I think, for me, that grabbed me as, I'm going to say, a non-fan of Venom. And I think people who are fans of Venom have been liking it, too. So he clearly found the right note.
But this issue also has a Hulk covered in a symbiote fighting Carnage, which is kind of Metal. So,
yeah.
Dave, what all do you
I
got?
I feel like Carnage would get crushed. Is he just so badass now that he can take that kind of
Carnage
stuff?
Carnage is kind of badass
now. Okay, all right. Let's see. I didn't read necessarily all these things, so y'all pipe in if you've read them. Marvel has a humor one-shot, I think one-shot, called Crazy.
That's our old magazine that tried to compete with Mad.
Is it a one-shot, Randy?
I don't know.
Okay. But, yeah, back in the... I remember it existing alongside Cracked.
Yeah.
I remember Cracked. I don't
oh,
remember
man,
Crazy.
I remember Cracked,
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cracked, which went on to become a very popular website by completely changing what they do.
Yeah, it's true.
Anyway... Flipping through this, what it looked to me more than anything was like Marvel also had What the, and like not Brand Eck, I think, in the 80s.
Yep.
And then What the in like the 90s. It's a bunch of goofy one-page vignettes or like all kinds of different spoofs. It is ridiculous.
Yeah. Rejected Marvel comic books.
What is it?
Rejected Marvel comic books. Ghost Hitcher. The Astonishing Aunt May.
I see Tub Mariner, which is a submariner having his bathtub adventures.
Yep.
So it is goofy as hell, but like I think this may have some people who will enjoy it.
Tales to Admonish. There's the Hulk fighting the Vapor. And there's a speech bubble saying, "Stick around, kids. After Hulk smash Vapor, Puny Banner will talk to you about the dangers of vaping."
Fingers on the pulse of the news. Did either of y'all read The Marked or have any comments on it?
So it is about tattoo witches.
It's from David Hein, who's done some interesting supernatural urban fantasy stuff before. Was that David Hein?
Yep.
Yeah, but if, a new one from Image that you might want to check out. I forget, is the art? Yeah, the art's really nice. Let's see. If you are an old-school DC fan, or maybe if you aren't, I don't know, they have a Metal Men series, 12-issue miniseries from Dan DiDio. I cannot say I've been a big fan of Dan DiDio's writing over the years, but I do like the Metal Men, so that's at least got to be worth a look. And then I wanted to mention what could have been a pick. We ran out of it last week, and it is a last week book. The fourth issue of Blade Runner was great.
They sent us, there are three covers,
yep,
and they're sending those over the course of 3 weeks.
Thanks.
Yep.
But that said, like, I think right from the first issue, we were like, huh, you know, they've never really managed to pull this off and get a Blade Runner comic out there. There doesn't seem like Titan would be the guys to get it right.
I think we were all skeptical. We did not expect much out of it.
This writer came through.
Yep.
It feels like the movie, or movies, I should say, at this point. It had a great ending that had, like, really gripping stuff going on. And I was like, what the hell are this going to happen? This is serious shit going down. And, like, had an emotional payoff. A lot of the mystery stuff was answered in the third issue, so that there was like they knew when it was time to give answers, and it was all cool stuff. So I feel like if you're a Blade Runner fan, whenever this comes out in trade, it's a must have.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. And there's enough of a it's a complete story, but it says end of book one.
Yep. Yeah, they so absolutely do some more. Intend to do more, and I'll be there for it.
Yeah. All right. Also on for me, History of the Marvel Universe number 4 comes out. This one is dealing with basically the 70s through the 90s. So a lot of the stuff that I was reading, there's nods to the West Coast Avengers, the formation of Excalibur and X-Force, the Clone Saga, Maximum Carnage, Onslaught, all kinds of stuff in here. It's really good.
Art is always so nice in it.
Spectacular art by Javier Rodriguez. Star Wars, Journey to Star Wars, The Rise of Star Wars, Journey to Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, Star Wars Allegiance, number 2. Comes out this week.
AKA prequel to the next Star Wars movie.
Yeah. It is. It takes place between Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker, written by Ethan Sachs. It is basically in the classic sort of Star Wars and comics tradition, Leia Organa, Rey, Chewbacca, and Rose go to the water planet of Mon Calamari to make a diplomatic deal, while Jake and Finn and some other rebels are off trying to reclaim a weapons cache and being hunted by bounty hunters. It's a lot of fun. It's an interesting look at sort of the post-Last Jedi resistance, and I'm enjoying it quite a bit. Once in Future number 3 is more of Evil King Arthur and the grandma and her son who have to stop Evil King Arthur. It's another Kieran Gillen book with Dan Mora on art. I'm enjoying this. I feel like it's going to read better in trade where I can get more of a sense of the story, but it's got beautiful art and I'm digging the story. And then just wanted to mention a couple of new number ones I didn't get a chance to read, but The Mask returns in I Pledge Allegiance to the Mask and Robotech Remix, which is basically their updated take on the Southern Cross aspect of Robotech. I gather in the Robotech comics that Titan did, they already remixed kind of like Dana, who's the daughter of Max and I can't remember who these characters are.
I never saw Robotech.
There's this character who was she was the daughter who was the lead in Southern Cross. She was there was 20 years between the first one and then her.
Yep.
And in this one, she like time travels back to the Macross War, and helps her parents win the war, and now she's there.
Time travel. What? Yeah.
There's some interesting stuff. I have not been keeping up with it, but apparently, if you're a Robotech fan, you might want to check this stuff out. And then of course. issue two of Black Panther and the Agents of Wakanda, which finds Black Panther and his weird team of Fat Cobra and Wasp and some other people fighting a big Marvel Universe threat. That's all I've got this week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some TV and movies and other stuff. All right, so first off, in our continuing coverage of what we're watching for Halloween, we've sent Dave out of the room.
Yep.
Because he's too scared for this discussion.
I think it's more like he wants to watch it.
That's
so,
true. We didn't want to spoil it.
We didn't want to spoil.
So we watched Little Monsters over on Hulu, which yep. Is it an Australian movie?
It is. It was produced and made in Australia.
Okay. So it stars Lupita Nyong'o.
Yep.
And the dude who's... Is that dude from anything? Or is he
I don't know. I didn't recognize him from anything.
So basically it is about a zombie invasion of an Australian kids petting zoo.
Well, yes. It's like a U.S. military installation that I guess was researching a longevity thing that right. causes a zombie outbreak.
Yep.
And yeah, there's a petting zoo next door for some weird reason.
And so Lupita Nyong'o plays this kindergarten teacher. She is accompanied on this trip. One of her kids, his uncle, is this sort of wastrel ex-musician who just had a bad breakup, and he falls for the teacher and decides to come along as a chaperone and basically to try and bang her.
And which is weird because the first 20 minutes of this movie is all about him.
And it's weird because I told you, Nick, as I'm watching this, I had seen the trailer.
Yeah.
And I saw, oh, this is about a kindergarten class yeah. and a zombie outbreak. And... there's no Lupita Nyong'o, there's no kindergartners, there is this jackass of an ex-musician who's, like, earned a breakup with this girl and yep. then can't handle it, and moves in with his sister, is a jackass to her. It's 20 minutes of this, and I kept pulling down the thing, like, is this definitely the right movie?
Although I was amused when he drags his nephew to go back and sort of propose marriage to his ex yep. while he's dressed as Darth Vader.
Yeah, that was... And it's one of those things like, why would you think this is a good way to do this? And why would you think this is the thing you should do? And yeah, it goes horribly wrong.
Of course it does. And you kind of get this notion that he is a slime bag. There's no other word for it.
I hated this character.
Yeah.
And then they redeemed him so well that I actually loved him by the end.
Yeah. The character arc is great, actually.
Then they go to this petting zoo.
Yep.
And it happens that an American... children's host is there doing his world tour, played by Josh Gad, and he is such a jackass.
He's against type of everything that Olaf stands for.
Yeah, he's a sex addict.
A drug addict.
When the zombie outbreak happens, he locks himself in the safe place, like the gift shop. And refuses to let them in, despite the fact that it's like 10 kids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, a class of kids.
He fights the other dude while trying to keep them all out. And then later he betrays them again.
Yep.
Like, again and again, you think that he's gotten his. Because you're watching two redemption arcs, like, oh, they're both going to get redeemed. Nope, he's an asshole.
Yep. But he gets his.
In zombie tradition.
In a hilarious way.
This, I don't know how to describe the tone of this, because the zombies are very real, very effective, scary.
But they are the slow-moving zombies.
Yeah.
There's even a joke in there about the military people. They were like, are these the fast ones or are these the slow ones?
Yeah.
Because zombies apparently are a thing.
This is the thing we don't see. We're starting to see more of, and I'm glad. It used to be that when you had a zombie movie, nobody knew what zombies were.
Yeah.
Now everybody knows what zombies are.
Which I think is needed at this point.
Yeah, you can't have people who don't know what zombies are.
But I'm one of those people that is tired of zombies. So to make a zombie movie that is actually... fresh and original, and for me to care about it, is pretty damn good.
I've seen at least, I guess, two really good zombie movies.
I need to watch Anna and the Apocalypse because I know you guys like
Anna and the Apocalypse is great. If you like this, if you liked Anna and the Apocalypse or Shaun of the Dead, you will like this movie.
Yeah.
Like, they're all in the same boat.
I need to watch it.
Comedic, but the zombies are real. There's actually some threat. The characters are all really good.
Well, there's heart in this movie.
Yeah.
And Lupita Nyong'o could probably do a one-act play about, I don't know, painting a barn, and I would watch
it. She is so good. Because she's this, like, light, fun, great kindergarten teacher. And
utilizing Taylor Swift.
Yeah, and then she's a badass.
Yes.
Also, there's some cute, like, there's this whole runner about her liking sort of this dopey, you know, she likes Taylor Swift and she likes Neil Diamond.
Yep.
And then she plays the ukulele. And then the guy who's the musician, there's this great bit where he plays Neil Diamond to try and calm everybody down. Yep. And it's this really sweet moment.
It is.
And it's totally earned.
He bonds with his nephew in a way. And, I mean, there's some stupid things he does.
The nephew thing, too, really got me. I was like, that was great. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. I just thought it was a very smartly done, great dialogue, great characters, really good effects, like you said.
Yeah, the zombie stuff's really good.
But it's not afraid of, like, violence or the language. I mean, Josh Gad alone.
Oh, man, yeah.
About killed me. I was like, but it was a great movie. Yeah. I really would put it up there with Shaun of the Dead for me.
I do, too. I was hoping it was going to be good. When I'm watching the first, like, 20 minutes, I was like, I don't know if I want to watch a movie with this guy. And then it won me over, and I loved it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely worth watching. And it's on Hulu, so you can just check that out.
Exactly.
So Dave has returned because now we're not talking about zombies anymore. He's not scared anymore.
Right.
True.
Actually, just the fact that you said zombies is making me a little nervous, I'm going to keep a hand on the door.
Yeah.
If you're trying to visualize this, like I know a lot of you out there in our audience do, just go ahead and picture me standing with a hand on the door for the rest of this.
Yeah, yeah. If you email about the stuff and or whatever else that we've said you should email about in the body of your email, that's enough to make sure whether or not you did picture Dave with his hand on the door the whole rest of the podcast.
It would help me to know.
Yeah.
But I do want to see that movie, so I had to sneak off.
So Dave and I have seen, but Nick has not, the new show Primal. Or the first short, I guess?
The animated short from Gennady Tartakovsky, best known for probably Samurai Jack, but also the original Clone Wars shorts, which clearly inspired the CG Clone Wars that came after it, but were like a much more action-oriented, very short vignettes. I mean, it was Samurai Jack style.
So this is a wordless short set in sort of caveman times.
Yeah, in the way that it very much is like the vibe of caveman stories that they would do in the 50s or 60s, kind of boys' adventure stories where dinosaurs and cavemen would fight each other, and you didn't worry too much about the historicity of
it. The fact that they didn't ever coexist.
But it is silent.
It is. I mean, not silent, but words.
But no words. Not actually,
that's true.
Words.
That's true. It works as a it works on in the ways that he has always has as a pure action vignette. But there is some pathos to it because it's a dark story. Do we want to go ahead and say?
Yeah, so it starts off with this caveman fishing.
And he's like a big old brute.
He's a big old brute.
They kind of, the way they animate his, or design him, is such that his forearms and his legs are a little bit Popeye style. They get bigger instead of tapering.
Yeah, he's spear fishing. He's like getting fish. And then there's this great moment where it's like this quiet thing, and he's looking into the water, and this big old like gator thing comes up at him.
Yeah, I think it's one of those like pre-Cambrian gators that are like, you know, 30 feet long or something like that, and they actually freeze frame on it and hit you with the title then.
And then there's very much a feeling as he's going that, like, that this is a world in which monsters are very real and can just eat you at any moment.
Yeah.
And then he's going back, and
it's really the fishing thing. I just want to mention, there's some interesting attention to detail there. They wanted to give you a sense of it, so that's like 2 or 3 minutes you see of him doing that, with you hear the buzzing of like flies and stuff all around, and the sort of the prehistoric like bugs and stuff, and he is just like completely set and focused on what he's doing. So Tartakovsky knows how to like let a moment be quiet, because usually that's the calm before the storm.
Yeah.
And but like it was interesting the detail with which he caught the fish.
Yeah, well, because they set it up and it very much is like this is him going about his day, and then
it's just that his day might include something like that.
Yeah, the notion of basically like that monsters are all around, and that pays off because then there's like a shriek and he drops his fish and he goes running, and it's very clear from context, oh, this is his family, and there's like this, an Allosaurus type thing?
Yeah, it's, well, I got a little mixed up in there. There's two types of dinosaurs. There's like a Tyrannosaurus and some smaller Allosaurus type ones.
Yeah.
Both of whom have a very important role to play in the plot.
And they are chasing down his family. And I was expecting he goes with a spear and saves his family. But instead, his wife and 2 children are eaten up so fast.
Yeah.
It's like you don't even know what's happening.
Yeah. Ooh. And kind of, I don't want to say quite gorily, but you do see like,
it's brutal, you see them though.
In silhouette as he like flings one of the kids up in the air, chomps down on it, and then you see the blood flowing from his mouth.
Yeah.
It is this is influenced as much, I'd say, by heavy metal.
Yeah.
So it's not as it is by Samurai Jack. It's the same animation style of Samurai Jack, but probably the best animation he's ever done. It does look beautiful.
But heavy metal had a sort of, in addition to being kind of metal-ish, it had a sort of a goofy style, and this is straightforward brutality.
Right. But I guess, like, heavy metal was the first thing I saw with R-rated violence. It reminded me of, like, what is it, Den?
Yeah.
You know, from there. Where this guy is... early on, you saw that he's got to, like, run sometimes when there's threats. He is also kind of a Superman, though. He is, like... He, as a fighter, he is crazy good.
Yeah, but when it he's comes outclassed.
To it. He's outclassed.
I was not prepared for his entire family gone in less than 30 seconds. Yeah. Like, that was a surprise.
And then he's, like... he's like kind of like numb afterwards. Well, they kind of go through these.
He almost is going to commit suicide.
Yeah, and this is all told silently, and they let it breathe a bit.
Yeah, I think I was super impressed with the storytelling. I was super impressed with the animation. I'm curious where it goes from here. It is because of the silence. It's hard to like develop too much character stuff.
Right,
but
he knows how to tell a silent story.
But yeah, it's excellent storytelling.
And I guess we probably want to leave some mystery here. But there is some crazy dinosaur confrontations later on in the latter half of it. Like, with him fighting in some super cool ways, but also, like, incredibly violent.
Yeah.
There's a thing where he, like, picks up a rock, and he's, like, using it, like, sort of, like, almost like the end of a hammer, but he's, like, the handle. It's, like, hard to describe, but he fights with that giant rock.
Did I miss part of this?
Did you not see him fight dinosaurs?
I'm not sure I did.
Oh, man.
I saw him fight the Allosaurus. I thought I was throw the spear at one of them. Is that...
There was a large fight that involved two sets of dinosaurs fighting.
Okay.
A big dinosaur and several smaller dinosaurs.
Maybe I didn't see that.
Did you see him injure the leg of a dinosaur?
No, I don't think I did.
Oh, man.
I thought I'd seen the whole thing.
You
but I
missed
guess maybe
the craziest part. No wonder you were looking at me kind of weird when I said he's like a super fighter.
Yeah.
Because this was almost like him, imagine almost like Captain America versus a dinosaur, but more brutal. Because that's kind of what happened.
I thought I'd seen the ending. Maybe there was the mid-credits or something.
Or maybe what I saw was somehow two episodes back-to-back, and they were each 15 minutes. Because what I saw was for sure a half hour long.
Where are these being released?
I was watching it on, like, the website for, like...
It's Adult Swim.
Adult Swim, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I just followed the link that somebody sent to me, and I just watched, like, a half hour.
I assume eventually these will wind up on Hulu or something like that.
I would hope so.
Now, here's the thing. It was actually, like, a little too kind of gratuitous for me at times. I think I may watch a second episode to see what happens, but even though I, like, really like sort of Ice Age adventure stories and stuff like that, obviously it is, like, in that sort of fictitious, old-timey version of it. But I almost found it a little too weird and dark and violent.
It's weird. I would have thought this would have been right up your alley.
I knew from the trailers it probably wasn't gonna be, because I had seen some clips that were, like, real violent in it.
It's not 10,000 BC by Roland Emmerich.
Which was more of a family-ish kind of thing in its way. My go-to is Quest for Fire. It's a good one.
And the other thing, Nick, you and I both watched the first episode of Batwoman over on CW.
Yep.
I watched the second episode as well.
I completely forgot it was on and forgot to record it.
I think we both came down on this is a solid CW formula show.
Yeah.
The guy playing Luke Fox is good.
Yeah.
The sort of updates of the Batwoman story where her dad is the head of the Crows, which is the private security. The notion that Batman disappeared 3 years ago and Batwoman is, like, basically stepping into this Gotham that's been divided up.
Yeah.
There's some interesting changes that are made.
Yeah, they are.
Let me quick ask a few questions as someone who hasn't read many of the Batwoman comics and definitely I have not seen the show.
Okay.
So, Kate Kane is ex-military.
Yes.
No.
Yes. She got kicked out because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah.
And her girlfriend did sign the thing saying she wasn't a lesbian and went back in.
Okay.
And now
that's
she's working. Now she's working for the Crows and she's like an agent.
And the Crows is what?
That's the private military organization that's basically security of Gotham.
Blackwater kind of thing.
It's basically like they're super cops. They're the cops for Gotham.
And her father runs it.
Her father runs it.
Okay. I don't know if it's meant to be a commentary in any way, but, you know, we've all seen the increased militarization of police forces in the last 10 years or so.
They're not doing much about that. This is very much a
fantasy take on
it. They were needed in Gotham because the criminals were running wild without Batman.
Got it. And who's the supporting cast in it?
So her dad,
yep.
Her ex-girlfriend, Luke Fox, yep. Lucius Fox's son, who is like her tech. He's like a waiting security guy who knew about Batman for some reason.
Yeah,
and basically winds up having to be her tech guy and help run.
Historically, his dad knows about Batman.
Yeah,
he reminds me a lot of Mr. Terrific on Arrow.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
And any other notables for supporting?
No, I mean Alice, her sister, who is the main villain, but also is a big role in this.
Yeah.
And that's a that was one of the kind of a weird character in the comics.
She's very Joker-ish. She's got her Alice in Wonderland gangs. So they wear like the animal mask, like rabbit.
She speaks in kind of rhyme.
Yeah, yeah. She's it's funny how much she is a Joker figure.
Hey, in the
yeah.
comics where it's not kind of a little bit isolated like this, has the Mad Hatter come after her yet for like
trademark infringement?
Yeah, he's like, I do all the Alice and Alice in Wonderland themed crimes.
I actually think Batwoman has been pretty isolated from everything else.
I would like to see this. I'm not a super huge fan of the Mad Hatter, so I feel like you could elevate her by having her kill the Mad Hatter. He's like, you stole my trademark, and she's then like, she just bam. Off with his head.
Yeah. So it's got good action. It's got good production values. It's got solid writing. I think
as pilots go, I don't think it was the strongest of the CW pilots, but it's a solid show.
It goes without saying that a show with a gay lead is that's a superhero show is like a first, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and she has a half sister who's running a clinic down in old Gotham, and a
stepmother. I thought that was
this the first time we've seen Gotham in like ever on live action?
I think. I mean,
like a TV, I mean?
Other than that Gotham show.
That's true. But
in the CW show, yeah. They went to Gotham at one point in the crossover.
Yeah.
But
that one was...
Do they do anything to, like, make Gotham look Gotham-y? Or is it just a city?
No, it's just a city, but it's a good look.
It's dark. Yeah. It's grimy. It's pretty much a hellish place.
They've done a big divide between the haves and the have-nots. So the rich are sort of protected by private security, and everyone else is like kind of living on the streets and that kind of stuff.
I was gonna ask, like, if they had done like a live action Batman show, does this feel like it's very different from it?
No, it feels very similar. I mean, they've definitely the function of Batman being missing mm-hmm. is a huge part of what has changed Gotham.
And oh yeah, you know, I saw some people on the ads are like, "Wow, Batman would never leave Gotham." Although he's had, time and time again in the comics, there's been reasons.
Something happened.
He was absent for a long time in No Man's Land.
Yeah,
and that was a great story.
Yeah.
Okay, so we think that Batman's going to guest on this show at some point, same way Superman did on Supergirl.
I would assume at some point they'll bring Batman back, but who knows?
Interesting.
Or we will learn why he left.
Or we'll learn that he's dead. I don't know.
Well, for months and months, he was in a gutter dead. I'm interested enough in these pieces to check it out. I don't really watch any of the CW shows just because I don't make a lot of time for them. But whenever I do catch bits and pieces, I like them. Yeah. And especially, what are we watching? Legends of Tomorrow.
Legends of Tomorrow is bonkers.
Which is bonkers. But yeah, I think I want to check out at least the premiere. I'm sure I can find it somewhere.
And I just wanted to real quick mention, I watched El Camino on Netflix, which is the Breaking Bad sequel, basically. Basically an epilogue focused on Jesse Pinkman.
I've heard good stuff.
It's really, really good. It's in the same way that Better Call Saul is a prequel that nobody needed. El Camino.
But they came through, right?
Yeah. El Camino is an epilogue. Nobody needed this story, but it's really, really good. And if you like Breaking Bad and you want more of that universe, and I absolutely did, you will not be disappointed. I was very happy to spend these 2 hours with these characters.
Nice.
Is
it a finite story for him, or do you think...
It's a movie. It's a movie. It gives him his ending.
Okay.
And Robert Forster's in it. He's great. He was also, I forgot, a major character.
It was Robert Forster who passed away just recently,
yes.
right?
So
this is going to be like his final role.
It was
in a pretty awesome movie.
It was
awesome
his final role, and he's great in it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Good.
So, anyway, I would definitely recommend El Camino if you're a Breaking Bad fan.
Nice.
And that's it for us this week. It's super late, and we're about to reopen the store because we're crazy people.
Yep.
And until next week,
Yo Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.